After his meeting with the vice president, Donald Trump flew to Georgia for a rally in support of the Republican candidates in the United States Senate runoff. Even though the vice president had been steadfast in resisting the president's pressure, President Trump continued to publicly pressure Vice President Pence in his Georgia speech. Rather than focusing exclusively on the Georgia Senate runoff, Trump turned his attention to Mike Pence. Here's what the president said during that rally in Georgia.
Pence comes through for us, I have to tell you. I hope that our great vice president comes through for us. He's a great guy. Of course, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him quite as much.
So the president had been told multiple times that the vice president could not affect the outcome of the election, but he nonetheless publicly pressured Mike Pence to do exactly that by saying, quote, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him as much. Let's turn now to January 5th. Mr. Wood.
Thank you. That morning, meaning January 5th, the president issued a tweet expressly stating that the vice president had the power to reject electors. Let's look at what the president wrote. Quote, the vice president has the power to reject fraudulently chosen electors. Mr. Jacob, you've already told us about your meeting with Dr. Eastman and the president on January 4th. And you briefly made reference to the meeting you had with Dr. Eastman the next day, January 5th. Can you tell us a little bit more about that meeting with Dr. Eastman on January 5th? For example, where was the meeting? Who was there?
So at the conclusion of the meeting on the 4th, the president had asked that that our office meet with Mr. Eastman the next day to hear more about the positions he had expressed at that meeting, and the vice president indicated that sort of offered me up as his counsel to fulfill that duty. So we met in Mark Short's office in the executive office building across the way from the White House. Dr. Eastman had a court hearing by Zoom that morning, so it didn't start first thing, but rather started around 11. And that meeting went for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. Chief of Staff Mark Short was at that meeting most of the time. There were a few times that he left. And essentially, it was an extended discussion. What most surprised me about that meeting was that when Mr. Eastman came in, he said, I'm here to request that you reject the electors. So on the 4th, that had been the path that he had said, I'm not recommending that you do that. But on the 5th, he came in and expressly requested that. And I grabbed a notebook as I was heading into the meeting. I didn't hear much new from him to record, but that was the first thing I recorded in my notes, was request that the VP reject.
Just to be clear, you're saying that Dr. Eastman urged the vice president to adopt the very same approach that Dr. Eastman appeared to abandon in the Oval Office meeting with the president the day before. Is that correct?
He had recommended against it the evening before, and then on the 5th came in, and I think it was probably his first words after introductions and as we sat down were, I'm here to request that you reject the electors in the disputed states.
And you referenced a moment ago some handwritten notes, which you've provided to the Select Committee. I'd now like to show you those notes. As you can see, you wrote there at the top, the writing's a little bit faint in the copy, but you wrote, requesting VP reject. Does that accurately reflect what Dr. Eastman asked of you in your meeting on January 5th?
Yes.
And what was your reaction when Dr. Eastman said on January 5th that he was there to ask the Vice President of the United States to reject electors at the joint session of Congress?
I was surprised because I had viewed it as sort of one of the key concessions that we had secured the night before from Mr. Eastman that he was not recommending that we do that.
So what did you say to him?
Well, as I indicated, to some extent it simplified my task because there are more procedural complexities to the send it back to the states point of view, and I actually had spent most of my evening the night before writing a memorandum to the vice president explaining all of the specific provisions of the Electoral Count Act that that plan would violate. So instead, since he was pushing the sort of robust unilateral power theory, I've already walked the committee through the discussions that we had. I started out with our points of commonality, we're conservatives, we're small government people, we believe in originalism as the means that by which we're going to interpret this. And so we walked through the text, we walked through the history, and the committee has shown footage of Mr. Eastman on the stage on the 6th claiming that Jefferson supported his position in a historical example of Jefferson. In fact, he conceded in that meeting Jefferson did not at all support his position, that in the election of 1800, there had been some small technical defect with the certificate in Georgia. It was absolutely undisputed that Jefferson had won Georgia. Jefferson did not assert that he had any authority to reject electors. He did not assert that he had any authority to resolve any issue during the course of that. And so he acknowledged by the end that there was no historical practice whatsoever that supported his position. He had initially tried to push examples of Jefferson and Adams. He ultimately acknowledged they did not work, as we've covered. He acknowledged it would lose 9-0 in the Supreme Court. He again tried to say, but I don't think the courts will get involved in this. They'll invoke the political question doctrine, and so if the courts stay out of it, that will mean that we'll have the 10 days for the states to weigh in and resolve it. And then they'll send back the Trump slates of electors and the people will be able to accept that. And I expressed my vociferous disagreement with that point. I did not think that this was a political question. Among other things, if the courts did not step in to resolve this, there was nobody else to resolve it. You would be in a situation where you have a standoff between the President of the United States and, counterfactually, the Vice President of the United States, saying that we've exercised authorities that constitutionally we think we have, by which we have deemed ourselves the winners of the election. You would have an opposed House and Senate disagreeing with that. You would have state legislatures that, to that point, I mean, Republican leaders across those legislatures had put out statements, and we collected these for the vice president as well, that the people had spoken in their states and that they had no intention of reversing the outcome of the election. We did receive some signed letters that Mr. Eastman forwarded us by minorities of leaders in those states, but no state had any legislative house that indicated that it had any interest in it. So you would have had just an unprecedented constitutional jump ball situation with that standoff. And as I expressed to him, that issue might well then have to be decided in the streets. Because if we can't work it out politically, we've already seen how charged up people are about this election. And so it would be a disastrous situation to be in. So I said, I think the courts will intervene. I do not see a commitment in the Constitution of the question whether the vice president has that authority to some other actor to resolve. There's arguments about whether Congress and the vice president jointly have a constitutional commitment to generally decide electoral vote issues. I don't think that they have any authority to object or reject them. I don't see it in the 12th Amendment, but nonetheless. And I concluded by saying, John, in light of everything that we've discussed, can't we just both agree that this is a terrible idea? And he couldn't quite bring himself to say yes to that, but he very clearly said, well, yeah, I see we're not going to be able to persuade you to do this. And that was how the meeting concluded.
But you just described a terrifying scenario. Sounds like there could have been chaos under the Eastman approach, and you even described it as it potentially could be decided in the streets. And you described several concessions that Dr. Eastman made throughout that discussion or even debate that you had with him. At some point during that meeting on January 5th, did Dr. Eastman seem to admit that both of the theories that he had presented to the United States the day before? So the theory that the vice president could reject electors outright and declare Donald Trump the winner, and his less aggressive theory that the vice president could simply send it back to the states. At some point in that conversation on the 5th, did Dr. Eastman seem to admit that both of these theories suffered from similar legal flaws?
So I had at least one, possibly two other conversations with Dr. Eastman later that day. In the earlier meeting, we really were focused, because his request that he made had been reject the electors outright, on why that theory was wrong and why we certainly would not be doing that. Later that day, he pivoted back to, well, we hear you loud and clear, you're not going to reject. But remember last night, I said that there was this more prudent course where you could just send it back to the states. Would you be willing to do that? And during the course of our discussion about his renewed request that we consider that option, he acknowledged to me, he put it, both Mr. Eastman and myself are graduates of the University of Chicago Law School, and he said, look, as graduates of that august institution, you and I will mutually understand that the underlying legal theory of plenary vice presidential authority is what you have to get there. Because this new theory, as I was pointing out to him, or the procedural theory, still violates several provisions of the Electoral Count Act, as he acknowledged. And the only way that you could ever be able to ignore several provisions of statutory law is if it was pretty clear that they were unconstitutional. And the only way they could be unconstitutional is if the vice president had the plenary authorities that were formed the basis for the reject the votes as well. So he acknowledged in those conversations that the underlying legal theory was the same. He just thought that the send it back to the states option would be more politically palatable, and he hoped more palatable to the vice president for that reason.
And in fact, when Dr. Eastman made this concession during that meeting, according to your deposition, Dr. Eastman said, just between us, University of Chicago chickens. Is that right?
I don't think that the University of Chicago is going to start a Chicago Chickens fundraising club. But yes, that is the terminology that he used. He said, you know, just between us Chicago chickens, we will understand, as lawyers who have studied the Constitution, that the underlying basis really is the same.
I reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wood. Mr. Jacob, the President and the Vice President meet again on that same topic the next day, January 5th, correct?
So after my extended meeting with Mr. Eastman that morning, during that time, the Vice President had been back at his residence working on his statement to the nation that we released the next day. He got down the house some point between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock as my meeting with Mr. Eastman was wrapping up. And when we, Mark Short and I, went over to meet with the vice president, and actually we thought maybe we had good news. We felt like we had sort of defeated Mr. Eastman, that he was sort of acknowledging that there was no there. But the vice president was then asked down to the Oval Office, and he went down to the Oval Office while Mark and I stayed back in the vice president's office.
You weren't in that meeting.
I was not.
In the book Peril, journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa write that the president said, quote, "If these people say you have the power, wouldn't you want to?" The vice president says, quote, "I wouldn't want any one person to have that authority." The president responds, "But wouldn't it almost be cool to have that power?" The vice president is reported to have said, "No, look, I've read this, and I don't see a way to do it. We've exhausted every option. I've done everything I could, and then some, to find a way around this. It's simply not possible. My interpretation is no." To which the president says, "No, no, no. You don't understand, Mike. You can do this. I don't want to be your friend anymore if you don't do this." We asked Mark Short about this during his deposition.
An understanding that I would have in other conversations with the vice president, he articulated to me that no, he wouldn't want that power bestowed upon any one person.
Mr. Jacob, did you, Mr. Short, and the vice president have a call later that day again with the president and Dr. Eastman?
So, yes, we did.
And what did Dr. Eastman request on that call?
On that phone call, which I believe was around 5 o'clock that afternoon, Mr. Eastman stated that he had heard us loud and clear that morning. We were not going to be rejecting electors. But would we be open to considering the other course that we had discussed on the 4th, which would be to suspend the joint session and request that state legislatures re-examine certification of the electoral votes?
That same day, January 5th, the New York Times ran a story about the disagreement between the president and the vice president about whether the vice president could determine the outcome of the election. Even though the New York Times story was indisputably correct, Donald Trump denied it. Trump issued a statement claiming that the vice president had agreed that he could determine the outcome of the election, despite the fact that the vice president had consistently rejected that position. Let's look at what the president said in his statement. Quote, "The New York Times report regarding comments Vice President Pence supposedly made to me today is fake news. He never said that. The vice president and I are in total agreement that the vice president has the power to act." Mr. Jacob, how did the vice president's team react to the statement from the president that the vice president could take an active role in determining the winner of the presidential election?
We were shocked and disappointed because whoever had written and put that statement out, it was categorically untrue.
Vice President's Chief of Staff Mark Short had an angry phone call with Trump campaign senior advisor Jason Miller about this statement. Here's what Mr. Short and Mr. Miller told the committee about that call.
Okay, tell me about the conversation you had with Jason.
It was brief. I was irritated and expressed displeasure that a statement it could have gone out that misrepresented the vice president's viewpoint without consultation.
The statement says the vice president and I are in total agreement that the vice president has the power to act. Is that incorrect?
I think the record shows that that's incorrect.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been through many documents that clarify that this is not where the vice president was.
Right. So essentially, the president's sending out a baldly false statement about being in alignment, purported alignment with the vice president, despite all of the predicate that you indicated had gone before about their respective positions? Is that effectively what happened?
I interpret the statement as false. I'll let you figure out who sent it out.
When Mark Short contacted you, he was upset. Is that what you said?
He clearly was not pleased.
Tell us what he said.
What's the process for putting out a statement for a meeting where only two people were in the room?
Did he ask you to retract the statement?
No, he just, I think it went right to, what's the process for putting out a statement for a meeting when only two people were in the room?
And he clearly disagreed with the substance though, right? Because he said the vice president doesn't agree with this.
trying to think what exactly he said. I mean, the tone was very clearly that he used some language to strongly infer that the vice president disagreed with that take, but I don't remember what that language was.
Did he dictate this statement?
He dictated most of it. I mean, typically on these, I might have a couple of wording suggestions, or maybe I have a sentence or a rough framework or something of that. But I know with specificity on this one that it was me and him on the phone talking through it, and ultimately the way this came out was the way that he wanted to.
The dispute between the president and the vice president had grown to the point where the vice president's chief of staff, Mark Short, was concerned that the president could, in Mr. Short's words, quote, lash out at the vice president on January 6th. In fact, Mr. Short was so concerned about it that he talked with the head of the vice president's Secret Service detail on January 5th. Here is Mr. Short.
Concern was for the vice president's security, and so I wanted to make sure the head of the vice president's Secret Service was aware that that likely, as these disagreements became more public, that the president would lash out in some way.
After the recess, we will hear that Mark Short's concerns were justified. The vice president was in danger. Mr. Chairman, I reserve.
Pursuant to the order of the committee of today, the chair declares the committee in recess for a period of approximately 10 minutes. Committee will be in order. Gentleman from California, Mr. Aguilar, is recognized.
I'd now like to turn to the events of January 6th, 2021, which turned out to be a fateful day in our nation's history. Despite the fact that the vice president consistently told the president that he did not have and would not want the power to decide the outcome of the presidential election, Donald Trump continued to pressure the vice president, both publicly and privately. As you will hear, things reached a boiling point on January 6th, and the consequences were disastrous. In the middle of the night, on January 5th, into the morning of the 6th, around 1 a.m., President Trump tweeted at the vice president, meaning that the comments in response to the president's tweet would also show up on the vice president's Twitter feed. The tweet stated that the vice president could, quote, come through for us and send it back to the states. Then around 8 a.m. on January 6th, President Trump again tweeted, this time to say that the vice president could send it back to the states and, quote, we win, and that this is the time for extreme courage. Mr. Short told us during his deposition that the vice president started a meeting on January 6th in prayer. Here is what Mr. Short said.
You arrived at the vice president's residence.
As would often be the case, I recall that knowing it would be an important day, we gathered in prayer and often that would be something the staff member would lead. So it would have just been at that time, I believe, the vice president, myself, Greg, and Chris. And we would have just asked for guidance and wisdom, knowing that the day was going to be a challenging one.
Mr. Jacob, did you go to the Vice President's residences on the morning of January 6th?
Yes.
Who else was with you?
Mark Short, Devin O'Malley, our communications director, and Chris Hodgson, our legislative affairs director.
And did the Vice President have a call with the President that morning?
He did.
Were you with the Vice President during the call?
So we had been putting the Vice President had finalized his statement overnight. We were in the process of proofing it so that we could get that out. And we were told that a call had come in from the President. The Vice President stepped out of the room to take that call, and no staff went with him.
The President had several family members with him in the Oval that morning for that call. I'd like to show you what they and others told the Select Committee about that call, along with never-before-seen photographs of the President on that call from the National Archives.
When I got in, somebody called me and said that the family and others were in the Oval. And do I want to come up? So I went upstairs.
And who do you recall being in the Oval Office?
Don Jr., Eric, Laura, Kimberly, I believe Meadows was there. At some point, Ivanka came in.
It wasn't a specific formal discussion. It was very sort of loose and casual.
So then you said at some point there's a telephone conversation between the President and the Vice President. Is that correct?
Yes.
When I entered the office the second time, he was on the telephone with who I later found out to be was the Vice President.
Could you hear the Vice President or only hear the President's end?
Only hear the President's end. And at some point it started off as a calmer tone and everything and then became heated.
The conversation was pretty heated.
I think till it became somewhat, louder tone. I don't think anyone was paying attention to it initially.
Did you hear any part of the phone call, even if just the end that the President was speaking from?
I did, yes.
All right, and what'd you hear?
So as I was dropping off the note, I remember hearing the word wimp. Either he called him a wimp. I don't remember if he said, you are a wimp, you'll be a wimp. Wimp is the word I remember.
It's also been reported that the President said to the Vice President that something to the effect of, you don't have the courage to make a hard decision.
Words, I don't remember exactly either, but something like that, yeah. You're not tough enough to make the call.
It was a different tone than I'd heard him take with the Vice President before.
Did Ms. Trump share with you any more details about what had happened or any details about what had happened in the Oval Office that morning?
That her dad had just had an upsetting conversation with the Vice President.
Do you recall anything about her demeanor, either during the meeting or when you encountered her in Dan Scavino's office?
I don't remember specifically. I mean, I think she was uncomfortable over the fact that there was obviously that type of interaction between the two of them.
Something to the effect, the wording's wrong. I made the wrong decision 4 or 5 years ago.
And the word that she relayed to that the President called the Vice President, I apologize for being impolite, but do you remember what she said her father called him?
The P word.
Mr. Jacob, how would you describe the demeanor of the Vice President following that call with the President?
When he came back into the room, I'd say that he was steely, determined, grim.
Of course, the most dangerous part of what Donald Trump did on January 6th was what he did himself. As will be discussed in detail in a future hearing, our investigation found that early drafts of the January 6th ellipse speech prepared for the President included no mention of the Vice President. But the President revised it to include criticism of the Vice President and then further ad-libbed. Here is what the President said on January 6th after his call with Vice President Pence.
I hope Mike is going to do the right thing. I hope so. I hope so. Because if Mike Pence does the right thing, we win the election. All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify. And we become president, and you are the happiest people. And I just spoke to Mike. I said, Mike, that doesn't take courage. What takes courage is to do nothing. That takes courage. And then we're stuck with a president who lost the election by a lot, and we have to live with that for four more years. We're just not going to let that happen. And Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us. And if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country. And they want to recertify their votes. They want to recertify. But the only way that can happen is if Mike Pence agrees to send it back. So I hope Mike has the courage to do what he has to do. And I hope he doesn't listen to the rhinos and the stupid people that he's listening to.
Of course, we all know what happened next. The president's words had an effect. President Trump's supporters became angry. When the vice president issued his public letter, the crowd at the Capitol erupted in anger. The rioters, who had erected makeshift gallows, began chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." Testimony in our investigation has made clear what the target of the rioters' ire was: Vice President Mike Pence. The rioters breached the Capitol at 2:13 p.m. Now let's take a look at what was going on at the White House at this time. We received testimony that the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, was notified of the violence at the Capitol by 2 p.m., and likely earlier. The testimony further establishes that Mr. Meadows quickly informed the president, and that he did so before the president issued his 2:24 p.m. tweet criticizing Vice President Pence for not having, quote, courage to do what needed to be done. Here is what the president wrote in his 2:24 p.m. tweet while the violence at the Capitol was going on. And here is what the rioters thought.
Nothing but a traitor, and he deserves to burn with the rest of them.
So this all escalated after Pence. What happened to Pence? Pence didn't do what we wanted.
Pence voted against Trump.
Okay, and that's when all this started?
Yep. That's when we marched on the Capitol. We've been shot at with rubber bullets, tear gas.
We just heard that Mike Pence is not going to reject any fraudulent elector vote. That's right. You heard it here first. Mike Pence has betrayed the United States of America.
Pence betrayed us, which apparently everybody knew he was going to, and the president mentioned it like five times when he talked. You can go back and watch the president's video.
This is our Capitol. Let's be respectful to him. There's 4 million people coming in, so there's a lot of control. We love you guys. We love the cops.
It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming.
Although the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, has refused to testify before this committee, Mr. Meadows' aide, Ben Williamson, and White House Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Matthews testified that Mr. Meadows went to the dining room near the Oval Office to tell the president about the violence at the Capitol before the president's 2:24 p.m. tweet. In future hearings, you'll hear more about exactly what was happening in the White House at that time. But here is what some White House staff told the Select Committee.
Do you know where he went?
Yes, I followed him down the hallway, and I followed him into the outer Oval corridor, which is the hallway between the Oval Office hallway and the outer Oval section of the Oval Office. I followed him into that little corridor hallway. I saw him walk into outer Oval. I maybe took a step into outer Oval and then left. And I don't know where he went outside of that, but it looked like he was headed in the direction of the Oval Office.
You know, we had all talked about at that point about how it was bad and the, you know, situation was getting out of hand. And I know Ben Williamson and I were conferring, and we thought that the president needed to tweet something and tweet something immediately. And I think when Kaylee gave us that order of don't say anything to the media, I told her that I thought the president needed to tweet something. And then I remember getting a notification on my phone, and I was sitting in a room with Roma and Ben, and we all got a notification. So we knew it was a tweet from the president, and we looked down, and it was a tweet about Mike Pence.
I believe I had sent him a text saying that we may want to put out some sort of statement because the situation was getting a little hairy over at the Capitol. And then it was common for, after I would text him, I would just go down and see him in person.
You went down to speak with Mark Meadows after this. What was that conversation?
Very brief. I went down and told him the same thing I have in the text that I can recall. And I don't remember anything that was said between us other than I told him that. And to my recollection, he immediately got up and left his office.
Our investigation found that immediately after the president's 2:24 p.m. tweet, the crowds both outside the Capitol and inside the Capitol surged. The crowds inside the Capitol were able to overwhelm the law enforcement presence, and the vice president was quickly evacuated from his ceremonial Senate office to a secure location within the Capitol complex.
By 2:24 p.m., the Secret Service had moved Vice President Pence from the Senate chamber to his office across the hall.
The noise from the rioters became audible, at which point we recognized that maybe they had gotten into the building.
Then, President Trump tweeted, "Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. USA demands the truth."
It was clear that it was escalating and escalating quickly. So then when that tweet, the Mike Pence tweet, was sent out, I remember us saying that that was the last thing that needed to be tweeted at that moment. The situation was already bad, and so it felt like he was pouring gasoline on the fire by tweeting that.
30 seconds later, rioters already inside the Capitol opened the East Rotunda door just down the hall. And just 30 seconds after that, rioters breached the crypt, one floor below the vice president.
The Secret Service couldn't control the situation and do their job of keeping him safe.
At 2:26 p.m., Secret Service rushed Vice President Pence down the stairs.
I think they had been trying to figure out whether they had a clear route to get us to wherever it was that they wanted to move us to.
We moved pretty quickly down the stairs and through various hallways and tunnels to the secure location. Upon arriving there, there was further discussion as to whether or not we were going to leave the Capitol complex or stay where we were.
Vice President Pence and his team ultimately were led to a secure location where they stayed for the next 4.5 hours. Barely missing rioters a few feet away.
Approximately 40 feet. That's all there was. 40 feet between the vice president and the mob. Mr. Jacob, you were there. seeing that for the first time? Does it surprise you to see how close the mob was to the evacuation route that you took? The 40 feet is the distance from me to you, roughly.
I could hear the din of the rioters in the building while we moved, but I don't think I was aware that they were as close as that.
Make no mistake about the fact that the Vice President's life was in danger. A recent court filing by the Department of Justice explains that a confidential informant from the Proud Boys told the FBI that the Proud Boys would have killed Mike Pence if given a chance. This witness, whom the FBI affidavit refers to as W1, stated that other members of the group talked about things they did that day, and they said that anyone they got their hands on, they would have killed, including Nancy Pelosi. W1 further stated that members of the Proud Boys said that they would have killed Mike Pence if given a chance. We understand that congressional leaders and others were evacuated from the Capitol complex during the attack. We'd like to show you what happened after the Vice President was evacuated from the Senate.
Select Committee has obtained never-before-seen photos from the National Archives that show Vice President Pence sheltering in a secure underground location as rioters overwhelmed the Capitol. At 4:19 p.m., Vice President Pence is seen looking at a tweet the President had just sent, a tweet asking the rioters to leave the Capitol. After 4.5 hours spent on working to restore order, the Vice President returned to the Senate floor to continue the certification of electors.
So Vice President Pence was a focus of the violent attack. Mr. Jacob, did the Vice President leave the Capitol complex during the attack?
He did not.
Can you please explain why the Vice President refused to leave the Capitol complex?
When we got down to the secure location, Secret Service directed us to get into the cars, which I did. And then I noticed that the Vice President had not. So I got out of the car that I had gotten into, and I understood that the Vice President had refused to get into the car. The head of his Secret Service detail, Tim, had said, "I assure you we're not going to drive out of the building without your permission." And the Vice President had said something to the effect of, "Tim, I know you, I trust you, but you're not the one behind the wheel." And the Vice President did not want to take any chance that the world would see the Vice President of the United States fleeing the United States Capitol. He was determined that we would complete the work that we had set out to do that day, that it was his constitutional duty to see through, and that the rioters who had breached the Capitol would not have the satisfaction of disrupting the proceedings beyond the day on which they were supposed to be completed.
Let me see if I understand this right. You were told to get in the cars, and how many of the Vice President's staff got in the cars while he did not?
Most of us.
During our investigation, we received testimony that while the Vice President was stationed within the Capitol complex, he continued the business of government. We understand that the Vice President reached out to congressional leaders, like the Acting Secretary of Defense and others, to check on their safety and to address the growing crisis. In addition, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Mark Short, made several calls to senior government officials. Here's Mr. Short's testimony regarding his call with Representative Kevin McCarthy.
He indicated that he had had some conversation. I don't recall whether it was with the president or somebody at the White House, but I think he'd expressed frustration that not taking the circumstance as seriously as they should in that moment.
All right. So Mr. McCarthy indicated he'd been in touch with someone at the White House, and he conveyed to you that they weren't taking this as seriously as they should. You have to answer yes or no. Okay.
While the Vice President made several calls to check on the safety of others, it was his own life that was in great danger. Mr. Jacob, did Donald Trump ever call the Vice President to check on his safety?
He did not.
Mr. Jacob, how did Vice President Pence and Mrs. Pence react to that?
With frustration.
Mr. Jacob, immediately before you and the Vice President were evacuated to a secure location within the Capitol, you hit send on an email to John Eastman explaining why his legal theory about the Vice President's role was wrong. You ended your email by stating that, quote, thanks to your bullshit, we are now under siege. We'll take a look at that email. Now, Dr. Eastman replied, and this is hard to believe, but his reply back to you was, the siege is because you and your boss, presumably referring to the Vice President of the United States, did not do what was necessary to allow this to be aired in a public way so the American people can see for themselves what happened. Mr. Jacob, later that day, you wrote again to Dr. Eastman. Let's show that email on the screen. In that email, you wrote, and I quote, did you advise the president that in your professional judgment, the vice president does not have the power to decide things unilaterally? And you ended that email saying, it does not appear that the president ever got the memo. Dr. Eastman then replied, he's been so advised. And he ends his email with, quote, but you know him, once he gets something in his head, it's hard to get him to change course, close quote. Mr. Jacob, when Dr. Eastman wrote, once he gets something in his head, it's hard to get him to change course, did you understand the he in that email to refer to the President of the United States?
I did.
And Mr. Jacob, did you hear from Dr. Eastman further after the riot had been quelled? And if so, what did he ask?
Late that evening, after the joint session had been reconvened, the vice president had given a statement to the nation saying that violence was not going to win, freedom wins, and that the people were going to get back to doing their work. Later that evening, Mr. Eastman emailed me to point out that, in his view, the vice president's speech to the nation violated the Electoral Count Act, that the Electoral Count Act had been violated because the debate on Arizona had not been completed in 2 hours. Of course, it couldn't be since there was an intervening riot of several hours. and that the speeches that the majority and minority leaders had been allowed to make also violated the Electoral Count Act because they hadn't been counted against the debate time. And then he implored me, now that we have established that the Electoral Count Act isn't so sacrosanct as you have made it out to be, I implore you one last time, can the Vice President please do what we've been asking him to do these last 2 days, suspend the joint session, send it back to the states.
And we'll show you the text of that email, which Dr. Eastman wrote at 11:44 p.m. on January 6th. So after the attack on the Capitol and after law enforcement had secured the Capitol, he still wrote, as you described, quote, so now that the precedent has been set that the Electoral Count Act is not quite so sacrosanct as was previously claimed, I implore you to consider one more relatively minor violation and adjourn for 10 days to allow the legislatures to finish their investigations. So even after the attack on the Capitol had been quelled, Dr. Eastman requested, in writing no less, that the vice president violate the law by delaying the certification and sending the question back to the states. Is that correct, Mr. Jacob?
It is.
Did you eventually share Dr. Eastman's proposal with Vice President Pence?
Not right at that time, because the vice president was completing the work that it was his duty to do. But a day or two later, back at the White House, I did show him that final email from Mr. Eastman.
And what was Vice President Pence's reaction when you showed him the email where Dr. Eastman, after the attack on the Capitol, still asked that the vice president delay it and send it back to the states.
He said, that's rubber room stuff.
I'm sorry, Mr. Wood. He said it's rubber room stuff?
Yes, Congressman.
What did you interpret that to mean?
I understood it to mean that after having seen play out what happens when you convince people that there is a decision to be made in the Capitol legitimately about who is to be the president and the consequences of that, that he was still pushing us to do what he had been asking us to do for the previous 2 days, that was certifiably crazy.
We know that the vice president did not do what Dr. Eastman requested because he presided over the completion of the counting of electoral votes late in that evening.
The number of electors appointed to vote for president of the United States is 538. Within that whole number, a majority is 270. The votes for president of the United States are as follows. Joseph R. Biden, Jr. of the state of Delaware has received 306 votes. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 232 votes. The whole number of electors appointed to vote for vice president of the United States is 538. Within that whole number, a majority is 270. The votes for vice president of the United States are as follows. Kamala D. Harris of the state of California has received 306 votes. Michael R. Pence of the state of Indiana has received 232 votes. The announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected President and Vice President of the United States, each for the term beginning on the 20th day of January, 2021, and shall be entered together with the list of the votes on the journals of the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Mr. Jacob, we heard earlier that you and the vice president and the team started January 6th with a prayer. You faced a lot of danger that day. And this is a personal question. But how did your faith guide you on January 6th?
My faith really sustained me through it. I, down in the secure location, pulled out my Bible. Read through it, and just took great comfort. Daniel 6 was where I went, and in Daniel 6, Daniel has become the second in command of Babylon, a pagan nation, but he completely faithfully serves. He refuses an order from the king that he cannot follow, and he does his duty consistent with his oath to God. And I felt that that's what had played out that day.
It spoke to you?
Yes.
At the end of the day, Mark Short sent the vice president a text message with a Bible verse. Here's what he told the select committee.
At 3:50 in the morning, when we finally adjourned and headed our own ways, I remember, you know, texting the vice president a passage from 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7 about, I've fought the good fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith.
He started his day with a prayer and ended his day with a Bible verse. I've fought the good fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith. White House attorney Eric Hirschman testified that the next day, January 7th, he received a call from Dr. Eastman. Here is Mr. Hirschman's account of that call.
The day after, Eastman, I don't remember why he called me, he texted me or called me, wanted to talk with me, and he said he couldn't reach others. And he started to ask me about something dealing with Georgia and preserving something potentially for appeal. And I said to him, are you out of your effing mind? Right? I said, I only want to hear two words coming out of your mouth for now on. Orderly transition. And then he screamed and said, I don't want to hear any other effing words coming out of your mouth, no matter what, other than orderly transition. Repeat those words to me. And I screamed that. Eventually he said, orderly transition. I said, good, John. Now I'm going to give you the best free legal advice you're ever getting in your life. Get a great effing criminal defense lawyer. You're going to need it. And then I hung up on him.
In fact, just a few days later, Dr. Eastman emailed Rudy Giuliani and requested that he be included on a list of potential recipients of a presidential pardon. Dr. Eastman's email stated, quote, I've decided that I should be on the pardon list, if that is still in the works. Dr. Eastman did not receive his presidential pardon. So let's see what Dr. Eastman did as a result when he was deposed by this committee.
I assert my Fifth Amendment right against being compelled to be a witness against myself.
Did the Trump legal team ask you to prepare a memorandum regarding the vice president's role in the counting of electoral votes at the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021? Yeah. Dr. Eastman, did you advise the president of the United States that the vice president could reject electors from seven states and declare that the president had been reelected? Yeah. Dr. Eastman, the first sentence of the memo starts off by saying seven states have transmitted dual slates of electors to the president of the Senate. Is that statement in this memo true?
Yep.
Did President Trump authorize you to discuss publicly your January 4th, 2021 conversation with him?
Yep.
So is it your position that you can discuss in the media direct conversations you had with the President of the United States, but you will not discuss those same conversations with this committee?
Yeah.
Dr. Eastman pled the fifth 100 times. Finally, let's hear from a federal court judge, the only one to date who has opined on whether the president was involved in criminal activity. Page 36 of Judge Carter's ruling says, quote, based on the evidence, the court finds it more likely than not that President Trump corruptly attempted to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. Page 40 of the ruling says, quote, based on the evidence, the court finds that it is more likely than not that President Trump and Dr. Eastman dishonestly conspired to obstruct the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021. And page 44, Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history. Their campaign was not confined to the ivory tower. It was a coup in search of a legal theory. Mr. Jacob, what would have happened to our democracy if Vice President Pence had gone along with this plan and certified Donald Trump as the winner of the 2020 election?
So there would have been short-term and long-term effects. The short-term I previously described, a constitutional jump ball situation, political chaos in Washington, lawsuits, and who knows what happening in the streets. And you would have had the Vice President of the United States having declared that the outcomes of these state elections were incorrect. So for all of those reasons, there would have been significant short-term consequences. But in the long term, we would have established a situation where a vice president would have asserted that one person could have the authority to determine the outcome of an election, which is antithetical to everything in our democracy. It's antithetical to the rule of law. And so it would have been significant impacts, both in the short and the long term.
Judge Luttig, in the statement you released earlier today, you wrote that the efforts by President Trump to overturn the 2020 election were, quote, the most reckless, insidious, and calamitous failures in both legal and political judgment in in American history. What did you mean by that?
Exactly what I said, Congressman.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Mr. Jacob. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentlemen.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I want that back. Mr. Chairman, this was an informative hearing, a powerful hearing. I'm grateful for your leadership and the leadership of the distinguished vice chair. Donald Trump knew he lost the 2020 election, but he could not bring himself to participate in the peaceful transfer of power. So he latched on to a scheme that once again he knew was illegal. And when the vice president refused to go along with it, he unleashed a violent mob against him. When we began, I asked how we got to this place. And I think the answer to that question starts with the fact that people in positions of power put their political party before their country. It cannot be allowed to continue. I'll yield back now, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Wyoming, Ms. Cheney, for a closing statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to my colleague, Representative Aguilar, and thank you very much to our witnesses today, Mr. Jacob and Judge Luttig. Thank you for being here with us. We have seen so far in our hearings that President Trump knew that his claims of a stolen election were false. You have seen that he knew that Mike Pence could not legally refuse to count electoral votes, and you have seen what President Trump did to pressure Mike Pence into taking illegal action. Over the course of our next hearings, you will see information about President Trump's efforts, John Eastman's efforts, the Trump legal team's efforts to apply pressure to Republican state legislatures, state officials, and others. Judge Carter has recently written, quote, Dr. Eastman's actions in these few weeks indicate that his and President Trump's pressure campaign to stop the electoral count did not end with Vice President Pence. It targeted every tier of federal and state elected officials. We will examine all of those threats, and we will examine the Trump team's determination to transmit materially false electoral slates from multiple states to officials of the executive and legislative branches of our government. We will examine the pressures put on state legislatures to convene to reverse lawful election results. An honorable man receiving the information and advice that Mr. Trump received from his campaign experts and his staff, a man who loved his country more than himself, would have conceded this election. Indeed, we know that a number of President Trump's closest aides urged him to do so. This committee will address all of these issues in greater detail in the coming weeks. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. Judge Luttig and Mr. Jacob, our nation owes you a great debt for your knowledge, integrity, and your loyalty to our Constitution. You and Vice President Pence are exactly the people our nation needed at a critical time. You had the courage to do what was right. In the weeks leading up to January 6th, many people failed this test when they had to choose between their oath to the country or the demands of Donald Trump. But there were others who, like you, stood tall in the face of intimidation and put our democracy first. They include the judges who rejected the bogus claims of election fraud, the senior Justice Department officials who stood up to Donald Trump, and the state officials whom we will hear from at our next hearing. We are deeply grateful to your courage and devotion to our country. There are some who think the danger has passed, that even though there were violence and a corrupt attempt to overturn the presidential election, the system worked. I look at it another way. Our system nearly failed and our democratic foundation destroyed, but for people like you. Judge Luttig, I want to give you an opportunity to share your thoughts on the ongoing. You've written the clear and present danger to our democracy. Now is that former President Donald Trump and other political allies appear prepared to seize the presidency in 2024 if Mr. Trump or one of his anointed candidates is not elected by the American people. What do you mean by this?
Mr. Chairman, I'm honored beyond words by your words. I was honored on January 6, 2021. Then also honored beyond words to have been able to come to the aid of Vice President Mike Pence. I prayed that day, just like the Vice President prayed that day. I believe we may have prayed the same prayer to the same God. I prayed that same prayer with my wife this morning before I came into these hearings. I have written, as you said, Chairman Thompson, that today, almost 2 years after that fateful day in January 2021, that still Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy. That's not because of what happened on January 6th. It's because to this very day, the former president, his allies and supporters pledge that in the presidential election of 2024, if the former president or his anointed successor as the Republican Party presidential candidate were to lose that election, that they would attempt to overturn that 2024 election in the same way that they attempted to overturn the 2020 election, but succeed in 2024 where they failed in 2020. I don't speak those words lightly. I would have never spoken those words ever in my life, except that that's what the former president and his allies are telling us. as I said in that New York Times op-ed, wherein I was speaking about the Electoral Count Act of 1887, the former president and his allies are executing that blueprint for 2024 in open and plain view of the American public. I repeat, I would have never uttered one single one of those words unless the former president and his allies were candidly and proudly speaking those exact words to America. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to appear here today for these proceedings.
Thank you again, Judge Luttig. As a part of the Select Committee's charge to make recommendations that are informed by other investigative findings, we will be reviewing the views shared by Judge Luttig and other experts on potential improvements to the Electoral Count Act, among a range of other initiatives. I know the information we presented over the last week is shocking. The idea that a president of the United States would orchestrate a scheme to stay in power after the people have voted him out of office. We're able to present this information because so many witnesses have cooperated with our probe. But the fact is, there are more people with direct knowledge, with evidence germane to our investigation. I ask those who might be on the fence about cooperating to reach out to us. The committee's website address is being displayed behind me, january6.house.gov. There you can view the evidence we presented in our hearings and find a tip line to submit any information you might think would be helpful for our investigation. And despite how you might not think it's important, send us what you think. And I thank those who've sent us evidence for their bravery and patriotism. Without objections, members will be permitted 10 business days to submit statements for the record, including opening remarks and additional questions for the witnesses. The chair requests those in the hearing room remain seated until the Capitol Police have escorted members from the room. Without objection, the committee stands adjourned.